Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I'm Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
That's right, buddy. This is a listener question episode, which means we are going to take five different listener questions, ranging all sorts of topics, but we are going to cover how to negotiate your rent with your landlord. We've got a question about that. We've got a question from a parent who is wanting to make sure that they are taking steps to protect their child's social security number, which is, yeah, an important thing to do. And also, too, we've got a question regarding what to do when you're getting close to the IRA income limits that keep you from being able to contribute to a Roth IRA or a traditional IRA. We're going to get to that question there later on, plus two others, buddy.
What's our advice going to be there? Just make less money?
Make less money. That's how you avoid those limits for
sure. That would be bad advice, though. We're not going
to
do that.
The same thing goes when it comes to tax brackets. It's like, hey, you want to avoid that 22% tax bracket? Make sure you just earn less money.
Exactly, yeah. negotiate that salary reduction. That's what we're all aiming for, right?
Yeah. But what you've got a note here about an electric vehicle, which I'm not sure you are qualified to talk about because you no longer have an electric vehicle.
You're right. I'll shut my mouth right now.
What's this all about?
Yeah, I saw something recently in our How to Money Facebook group, and there was some chatter, somebody looking to potentially lease an electric car, get in on the EV game. And someone had mentioned in the comments of that post, hey, don't forget to factor in the expenses that go alongside of purchasing an electric car. Putting in a level 2 charger at your house, getting an electrician to essentially make sure that you can charge your car at your house, right? Sometimes, yeah. Often there's electrical work that needs to be done in order to make sure that you're able to charge that car.
Yeah, with a level 2 charger, that typically requires a 220 volts outlet, and that requires some open space on your electrical panel.
Yep, exactly.
You got to make sure it's not full up.
And so real quick, I just wanted to comment on that idea, especially as electric vehicles become more and more commonplace. That's a question that people have to wrestle with. All right, do I need to hire an electrician in order to get this level 2 charger put in? Could cost you $1,000 or something like that in order to do both, to buy the charger and have it installed. But I just want to suggest to a whole lot of people out there that that might be a cost that you don't need to pay. Matt, I know I'm not an expert on this anymore, but I did own an electric car for...
You're very experienced, though.
...for 6.5 years, and recently, sold my Nissan Leaf. It was a sad day. I miss it already. But I never bought a level 2 charger for my Nissan Leaf. I only plugged it into, a standard electrical outlet.
Yeah, you were just using that USB charger. right. Basically, you can plug your phone into that same charger. You got it off Amazon for $5, and you can also plug your car into it.
Pretty sweet, right? Yeah.
No. It'll take like 6 months to charge your car. Not possible.
No, not possible. Yeah. But I did need a 3-prong outlet, which was gotcha. Outside the house. But yeah, I think for a lot of folks, that works perfectly fine. It charges your car a heck of a lot slower. But especially with the range that many of these vehicles are coming with these days, plugging your car in overnight for 12 hours before you drive it again the next day, your battery's going to get recharged a whole lot in that amount of time, even if you're just plugged into a standard outlet. And at the same time, one of the things we've talked about on the show before is charging your battery more slowly is better for the life of the battery, the long-term life. Hmm. So at the same time, you're not forking out the money up front to install, this fancier fast charger, and you're also going to be doing your battery a favor too.
Nice. Yeah, I like that. I like, basically, you're addressing the fact that you don't have to get all the fancy stuff. If you know what your needs are, and certainly, if you are driving a lot of miles in order to get to work and you get home and you only have, maybe 10 hours, and over the course of a week, I'm going to see my percentage drop, even when I charge it, as much as I can the minute I get home. I think it is important to actually consider your needs.
Yeah, your driving habits are crucial in the equation. Just don't assume that you got to get one.
Exactly, 100%, man. Yeah, totally agree.
All right, well, hopefully we saved at least one person from, an outlay of quite a bit of money to get that level 2 charger. All right, Matt, let's mention the beer that we're having on today's episode. This one is called Dark Side of the Strawberry Moon by Cherry Street Brewing. They are just about an hour north of us outside of Atlanta, and they make great beers. So I'm looking forward to having this one on the show today.
Yeah, that's right, man. I am looking forward to this one. And before we get into the actual questions, we want to let our listeners know that if you have personal finance or money questions, we would love to hear them. Head over to howtomoney.com/ask, and there are some simple instructions on how it is that you can easily record your question on your phone, as well as how you can easily shoot that voice memo over to us. It is crazy easy. And I feel like in general, too, the quality of the files we've been receiving, it's so nice. I mean, because, you know, the phones are designed to make those files sound so good. So we know a lot of folks like to reach out to us via email, but honestly, if we can get those as voice memos, we would love to take those on an actual Ask How to Money episode.
That's right. It's fun for us to hear your voice. It's fun for everybody else out there to hear your voice. That's why we do the voice memos, yes. And we don't answer email questions. Sorry. To those of you who email in,
we reply, but we don't always have the time to, you know, flesh out an entire specific response. But we would love to talk about it on the show.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We still love you. All right. Let's get to the first question, though. Matt, this one is about negotiating your rent.
Hello, Joel and Matt. My name is Lo, and I live in Indianapolis. I currently pay just over $1,300 a month for rent for my apartment. And with COVID, I know that rent prices have gone down, and I was curious. And now my apartment, the exact same size, just in the building next door, is going up for around $1,000 a month. So is there a way to approach my apartment company about maybe decreasing my rent or having that conversation? I really like where I live, and I'm not yet ready to buy a house, and I'm saving up for one. So this is kind of the best solution in that way. Thanks for all your help.
Well, that's a great question, especially too, given the falling rents that we are seeing in a lot of cities. I'm glad to see that you kept an eye out, you know, on what some of the apartments are going for around you, maybe in the building next door. And, you know, I love that you are willing to negotiate. Like, some people are too afraid to ask for a discount. So many people aren't negotiating. But the first thing, you know, that you're going to want to do is bring the facts, just like you're doing it. It sounds like you know the prices of the places near where you live. And so maybe just do a little bit more digging to find out what the average rent is in your part of town for a similar spot. So if you can go to that conversation and have maybe an average of, you know, three or four different prices of, you know, three or four different rates, like, this can help you with your case when you are asking for that discount. You aren't asking just because you want to pay less, but because, you know, the actual market suggests that they should cut you a break.
Yeah. And I think too, Matt, one of the keys in negotiating rent is to propose something that makes your landlord want to give you a discount. And
make it their idea.
yeah, exactly. Like Inception. You know, plant it in their brain and they're like, wait a second, this is brilliant.
Should we be paying you to live here? Hello, you are such a great tenant.
Such a good ambassador for this place. Yeah. And I think one of the keys is really to be kind about it. I don't imagine that Lowe was going to go in there guns blazing, like making people angry, but be super kind when you are asking for a discount. Turnover is, of course, like a real problem for so many landlords. It takes work to get the place ready for the next tenant, to find another good one, get them moved in there. Mm-hmm. And so if you have been a great tenant, you've been there for a while, maybe propose signing a longer lease. Something like that may get you a rent discount when your landlord might otherwise have been like, no go, I'm not interested.
Right.
So yeah, offer to sign maybe a 2-year lease and see if that works. Obviously, you're going to have to be okay living there for 2 years. You know, don't sign a 2-year lease if you're not willing to stay there longer. Being a little flexible and offering your landlord something in return for that reduced rent, that makes those negotiations go a whole lot smoother.
Yeah, and honestly, like, bigger landlords are often going to be less likely to budge than maybe some smaller mom and pop landlords. But you might be able to get, say, like a half-priced month, you know, or maybe some other perk instead of a recurring monthly discount, especially if your complex is kind of offering a bonus to new tenants who they are trying to attract. This is one of those instances where they're willing to reward the new customer, but we want to see them reward and make sure that they're taking care of the long-standing customers, you know, the folks like you who have been there for multiple years. In the end, too, it kind of just comes down to being the squeaky wheel, you know? And so if you can speak up, let your voice be heard, make it clear that, hey, I see what these other apartments are going for. I'd really love to be able to see my rent go down. Ask for that discount.
Yeah, sometimes you got to present your resume. Hey, I've been here 3 years and I've been a great tenant. I pay on time every single month. Don't you love tenants like me? Mm. Any way that you can strengthen your case, you know, by talking about how good of a tenant you've been is going to help. And sometimes, Matt, the only solution actually for somebody like Lo is that they have to move in order to get the best deal. I hope that's not the case in her situation because she seems to really like where she lives. But sadly, loyalty isn't always rewarded. And that's the case often with a lot of the bigger landlords and many of the big rental companies out there. They can be short-sighted. And there are often, you know, deals to attract new customers, like you mentioned, but there are rarely deals to make the current customers feel special and feel like they're also, you know, getting in on some of the savings. And so Lo, it's going to be best to also be willing to move and take one of those cheaper deals elsewhere if the management company at your current place refuses to make any concessions and give you any sort of a discount on your rent. Because like Matt said, rents have been falling in cities around the country. And if they're pretending that what you're paying for rent right now should stay the same for the upcoming year, they're not being realistic. And so you're going to have to do your best looking out for yourself.
And the added benefit too, if she does end up moving to the building next door, I mean, that's not a big move.
That's true. You might not have to hire movers.
You just like grab your stuff and just start slowly taking trips without having to hire a truck, without having to hire movers. But hopefully that's not the case. Hopefully you're able to maintain your current spot if that's a building that you've enjoyed. So we've got several more questions we're going to get to this episode, including one about placing a credit freeze, but on your kid's social security number. We'll get to that one right after the break.
All right, let's keep taking questions, Matt. And this next one comes from a listener who is concerned about her child's identity being stolen.
Hi, guys. After hearing your recent episode about getting a PIN from the IRS, my husband and I just did ours. Thanks so much. Now, my question is, how do we protect our baby's social security number from ID theft? Thanks for all you do. Love from Queens, New York City.
All right. And that question was from Kathy up there in Queens. And Kathy, we are so glad that you signed up for that IRS PIN. That's something that we talked about on a Friday episode, I guess maybe a little over a month ago. And it's super easy and nice to know that your tax return won't be messed with, you know, by a scammer, by, you know, taking that one simple step by getting that IRS PIN. It is important to mention, however, that if you want to protect your own identity from other potential methods of ID theft, then what you're going to need to do is actually freeze your credit with each of the major credit bureaus. This is a fairly simple process. And Joel actually just wrote an article up at howtomoney.com about how to do that. And we'll make sure to link to that in our show notes. This is something that all How to Money listeners should strongly consider doing. It is the best credit protection possible by far. And the best part, it's completely free.
I love free stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Even stuff I don't need sometimes, which sometimes leads to clutter. So I should probably not get crummy free stuff.
it's kind of like masks over the past 12 months, right? You're like, but it was a free mask. And then all of a sudden you've got all these masks with like Georgia Broadcasting logo on it. You got a mask from your gas company.
Everybody was giving white masks, that's for sure.
But it was also nice though.
I'm still rolling with the first mask that my mom gave me
really?
Like mid-March last year. So, but I totally agree with you, Matt, that credit freeze is the best protection possible for people when it comes to making sure their identity isn't stolen by some sort of criminal. Mm-hmm. And one thing that people need to know is that you don't want to sign up for credit monitoring. You actually want the credit freeze. And I went into that in depth in that article. But those services, the credit monitoring services, will often cost you about $10 a month. And they don't do nearly as much as the credit free does. And the freeze, as you mentioned, is free, right? So something free that does a way better job than the thing that costs $10, count me in.
Oh, yeah.
But let's move on to the actual question that Kathy had too, about protecting your kids from identity theft. You can also freeze their credit in the same way that you're freezing yours if they're under the age of 16. 16 and 17 year olds are allowed to freeze their own credit, but we would say that a freeze is the best answer for people of any age, children included. And it's a great thing that parents are now allowed to freeze their child's credit free of charge in a similar way in which they can freeze their own.
Yeah, and this is the best way to prevent someone from opening up credit in your kid's name and basically tarnishing it, you know, before they're even able to get to use it. And sadly, it's often a loved one or a relative who ends up being the identity thief. It's someone who kind of has access to, you know, your kid's social security number.
Right.
And so the annoying thing, too, is that it's not quite as easy as it is to freeze your own, which you can do completely online.
Yeah, in mere minutes.
Literally, yeah. it's super easy, really quick. But to do it for your kids, you actually have to gather some documents, send them in the actual mail, like snail mail.
Wait, like a letter?
Yeah,
like I don't do that anymore,
a stamp, that whole thing. And you would need to send that information to each of the three bureaus, including like a copy of their birth certificate, social security number, and some proof of your ID as well. And so we'll link to each bureau's process for freezing a child's credit in the show notes. But bottom line, Kathy, we are glad to hear that you're watching out for your kids, that you're going to hopefully lock it down and make sure that that their identity isn't being used to open up lines of credit that somebody else is going to be taking advantage of.
And Matt, you just said lock it down, and I love that you said that, but there is just one more thing I got to throw in when you say that. There is such a thing called a credit lock. The credit lock often costs money. Actually, some of the credit bureaus charge $25 a month to lock your credit, and they want to make it sound like the credit lock is even better than the credit freeze.
Because there's alerts associated with it, and they'll watch it, they'll keep an eye on it, but you do not want to do that. You don't want to avoid any product that sounds like credit lock, life lock, any of these sort of locks you want to actually avoid. It's unfortunate, though. Yeah, it has seeped its way into the vernacular a little bit just by even me saying it. But what you're looking for are specifically freezes.
Yeah, and that's
why freeze it.
You might want to follow the exact links that we put in that article, because it'll take you to the free spot on the website, and we don't want you to get jumbled up into the paid junk that you actually don't want to sign up for.
That's right. Freezes are free.
Yeah, and again, it's going to take just a little bit longer to freeze your child's credit. Like Matt said, you got to actually send in some forms, but it's going to be well worth it. You're watching out for your kid's credit, and that's great. All right, Matt, let's get to the next question. This one is about how much are you supposed to save for retirement?
Hey, Joel and Matt, this is Masa from Boston, and I have a question inspired by your episode about the seven money gears. I work for a local school that offers both a pension and a 401k. The school pays for the pension, and I contribute just enough to the 401k to snag all of the employer match, the second money gear. My HR department's crystal ball says that my retirement income is going to be 104% of the income I would earn in my last year of work if I retired age 65. The experts say that I should target 70% to 80% income replacement during retirement. Do you all have a target income replacement level I should shoot for? I ask because you all tend to recommend that we max out our retirement savings, but it seems like I'll do okay during retirement despite having skipped past the invest in tax shelter retirement accounts money gear. I don't have any debt left to pay off, lower interest or otherwise, so I'm presently cruising along in the top money gear, pursuing other big savings and investing goals. Anyway, thanks for your awesome podcast and keep up the good work. By the way, instead of using an Instapot, what I do to humidify my bedroom during the dry winter months here in New England is to hang a damp towel right before I go to bed. As it dries, it adds moisture to the air. And when you think the towel might be starting to get a little funky, just throw it in with the laundry. A machine washable humidifier, y'all.
Joel, you recognize this voice. This is Masa. He's back.
Our good buddy.
That's right.
I love hearing Masa's voice again on the show.
Masa, it's good to hear from you again. And thanks, too, for that suggestion. I really do love the idea, like you said, of being able to have something that's like something that you would normally have to clean by hand or replace. You know, a funky towel that's starting to get maybe a little bit of mildew or mold on it. But just, yeah, throwing that in the wash sounds super easy. And I also love that someone from Boston says y'all, although I don't think he actually says it. I think he's just, I don't know if he's making fun of us.
Do we say it too much?
Do we?
Maybe.
I think we do. I mean, we use it a proper amount. I say it just like I would normally in my real life, I guess. But
let's be honest, though. There's just no better way to say you all. And I know like some
you guys.
Use guys or whatever, but y'all is just like the most efficient way to say it.
It's a single consonant, so you can say it very quickly and easily. Y'all. I like it. But Masa, we love that you are in the top money gear right now, which is a huge accomplishment. And you have a pension and a 401k, which is super awesome. And so you mentioned the kind of like the retirement crystal ball, right? But the question we want to ask is how accurate is the forecast that, you know, the little calculator or whatever you're able to use there, maybe there on your retirement website, how well do you think that's going to actually reflect your future, right? We don't know your career goals, but there's probably a reasonable chance that, you know, that you're going to leave the job before you accrue, say, 30 years of service, making you maybe eligible for the full pension amounts. Most folks don't stay in a job that long, and you never know how your career goals might actually change. Pensions are nice, but they can sort of, you know, be like a bit of a golden handcuff situation, you know, like keeping you somewhere when, you know, you might otherwise prefer to pursue something different, maybe even move to a different city, maybe somewhere a little bit warmer where you don't have to worry about that humidifier, you know, as much.
Yeah. And your employer can also at any time say, actually, the pension, we're done. You won't be able to accrue additional service time. And so right now, maybe the crystal ball is making it seem like you've got 30 working years towards that pension. But if service time accrual stops now, I mean, this happened to my mom, you know, a few years ago. This happened to me a few years back at my former employer, where they were like, yeah, we're not doing that anymore. New hires don't get the pension. And people that are still hanging around who did qualify, well, guess what? You know, you're not going to have any more years added to your service time. So yeah, your pension stops here. So it can be really hard to make decisions solely based on those employer predictions. We would say that you should consider potentially contributing even more to that 401k or opening up a Roth IRA if you can. I think it can't hurt to save a bit more than that algorithm suggests based on those other possibilities. And it might also save you, Masa, from not having enough if you were to make a career move in the future.
Yeah, and so that actually raises the question, is it possible to save too much for retirement? And, you know, I do think the answer to that is yes, but that's not a struggle for most Americans, at least.
That's true.
If you're, you know, so intently focused on the future that you are sacrificing some of the smaller, you know, wants that you have today, then, you know, you should question whether your investing goals are perhaps too ambitious. Or, you know, you might be putting off other major purchases, like maybe buying a home, because you're stashing so much money away for the future. It's smart to make sure that you don't get so myopic when it comes to investing for retirement that you miss out on some of the important things now, that you possibly miss out on living life now as well.
Yeah. And Matt, I think that that can happen. And that's one of the things that the FIRE crowd has been, you know, accused of, at least financial independence, retire early, for the folks that are like, I want to retire at 40 and
or 30
or 30.
Yeah, exactly.
And sometimes that hyper focus on retirement can lead to massive amounts of deprivation. And we think there's a healthy balance that's deserved there in your life and in your personal finances. And I think another important thing to consider here, Masa, is, are you looking to do a bunch of traveling in retirement? Or are you actually looking to be one of those FIRE people and retire early? You know, maybe not at 30, but maybe at 50. Or will you have kids that you want to inherit some money when you eventually pass away? You want to prioritize retirement savings even more if that's the case.
Yeah, basically what we're talking about here is like what do you project your future lifestyle to look like? Like, what are your sort of ultimate long-term goals here?
Yeah, not just what that algorithm says your life's going to look like, but and says what your income and savings are going to look like over the next 15 years. Your life might look a whole lot different than what that algorithm is telling you. So Masa, hopefully that helps a little bit. You know, income replacement in retirement is a difficult question to answer. You know, the expert consensus has often said somewhere around 70% of your pre-retirement income is what you're going to want to have in retirement income. And you're right that many people who own a home mortgage-free won't need to be able to generate 100% of their current pay in retirement. But so much of that depends on the individual and what they want their retirement to look like. Like, are you going to be taking European cruises down the Danube like three times a year? I don't know. You got to factor all those kinds of things.
That sounds like Masa.
I mean, yeah.
I think he'd be down with
that. I can see him doing some of those Euro cruises. That sounds nice. But yeah, everybody's situation differs. And so you can't fully trust that crystal ball for a few reasons that we mentioned. And you also have to really take your own situation into account before you decide that you're going to, you know, stop investing as much as you're currently investing.
That's right. Yeah. So Masa, hopefully we were able to point you in the right direction. Joel, we've got a couple more questions that we're going to get to, including one about the best way to pay a credit card in order to obviously receive the benefits of using that credit card that we'll talk about here in a second, but without accruing interest. We're going to get to that one plus one other right after the break.
All right, Matt, we're back. We got a couple more questions to get to, including this question, which seems like it shouldn't be that hard, but it gets a little more detailed than it first seems about how you actually pay your credit card each month.
Hi, Joel and Matt. My name is Bedelia, and I'm from Plainfield, New Jersey. So my question is about credit cards and repayments. So I am well aware of the APR that's applied for the year. I've divided the math, figured it out by month, but now I'm having a hard time figuring out by days. So I started using my credit card, which has a zero balance, and I want to keep it that way to make purchases. For one, I want to get points off of it, get my money's worth, And two, I also want to keep my credit active and just try to maximize that in any way possible. So I'm having a hard time trying to figure out when to make my payments. Should I pay them off right away to avoid any daily interest? Should I pay them off at the end of the week, bi-weekly along with my paychecks, or at the end of the month? But then I can't help but to wonder, I'll be then paying for APR for the days that the balance was in the account, I guess. And the second part of the question would be, would this affect my credit score? How would it affect it if I make a payment right away, if I get gas on Monday and by Friday I have paid it off? Would that negatively affect the payment? Would the credit card company consider closing my account, which I do not want to do? Thanks, guys. I really look forward to the response. I hope you guys really get to answer my question. I really enjoy listening to you both. Thank you.
Hey, Bedelia, we love your attention to detail here. You know, your reasons for using a credit card for purchases is spot on. The rewards can be pretty solid, and it definitely helps your credit score too. So good call there. And there are other benefits too of using a credit card as a payment method, and we discussed those back in episode 149. So be sure to check that one out for even more great reasons. You know, credit cards rock. That is, if you use them well, and that is what your question is all about. You want to make sure that you're using your credit card exactly like you should,
to the fullest extent.
Yeah,
yeah. And Bedelia, when you should make that payment is a great question. It's important to note that you actually aren't paying interest on the charges that you make on that credit card, unless you don't pay your balances in full on the due date. So like, let's say I buy, you know, a couple avocados at the grocery store today, and I don't pay that credit card balance off for 3 days. I'm not paying daily interest on those avocados, fortunately, until after I'm past due on that balance. At that point, the credit card company will start to charge you interest on the unpaid amount. But when you make a purchase, the clock just doesn't start ticking right away. That's not how it works. You've got time, and you don't have to sweat it as hard as you're sweating it actually right now.
Yeah, and you're talking about basically the frequency at which you should maybe pay your card off. And some folks choose to pay their credit card bill more frequently, you know, like every week or maybe every 2 weeks. This can be annoying though, right? But it does have a couple of upsides, which is, like, first of all, you might find yourself more attentive to your purchases. You know, if you are paying every week or every 2 weeks, you're not going to reach the end of the month and look back and realize that, like, holy crap, like, I way overspent this month.
Like, how many avocados did I eat?
way too many. I've got a serious problem. And I think, too, by paying the bill more frequently, you're doing an even bigger favor for your credit score as well, because you're going to have a lower balance when the statement due date hits, and it'll reflect better on how much of your credit you are using. That it keeps your utilization rates low, which credit reporting agencies really like to see.
It's actually one of the top reasons your credit score goes up or down is how much of your available credit you're using. And so, yeah, by paying it more frequently every week or two, you are going to be helping your score out a little bit. For me, I'll say I'm a fan of taking more of a set it and forget it approach. Unless you have a specific reason to be hyper attentive to your credit score, like, let's say you are planning to do a refinance really soon and every point matters. You know, you want to get above 740 in order to get the best terms, just pay the balance in full every month on or before the due date. It keeps things simple. It means your brain doesn't have to be working overtime to, you know, to set a calendar reminder to pay that credit card balance every single week or every other week.
Yeah. Being able to set it on auto pay is a huge relief. I will say though, like, I personally don't use auto pay because I kind of, like, for me, I pay off my balance regardless of when the due date is or regardless of when the statement date is at the end of the month. Because, and this, I think a lot of folks are this way, right? Like, when they plan for the month, when they budget for the month, everything ends at the end of the month. And so for me, not carrying some of those transactions from the previous month over into the new month, right? So say you've got a statement that runs from the 15th basically to the next month's 15th. Well, there's a lot of kind of blending and crossing over that happens there. I don't like that personally. And so that's a part of why, you know, when I manually enter all of my numbers, all of my expenses into my Excel spreadsheet at the end of the month, I just manually pay that off myself. But that being said, I do only do it once a month. You know, I'm not revisiting that multiple times a month. That would keep my utilization down, but it's not truly going to have a significant effect on my credit score.
Yeah. And one other thing I wanted to mention for Bedelia's sake is she mentioned, you know, the possibility of the credit card company closing her account. And yeah, that was actually something that happened to a lot of people earlier on in the pandemic. We talked about that. Credit card companies were scared that people were going to lose their jobs, that they were going to rack up credit card debt and they weren't going to be able to pay their bills. But that's not something that people should be worried about in normal times. And yeah. And I think right now too, Bedelia, as long as you're using that card regularly, that's not something you need to be worried about. As long as you're using it, you know, a few times a year, preferably once a month, you shouldn't be worried about a credit card company shutting you down by either using that credit card too infrequently or by paying the balance off too much. You shouldn't be worried about that being a consequence of how you're handling those credit cards.
Yeah. Yeah. There are limits as to like how often you can pay on a card. I think like one that stands up my mind with one of my cards, I'm pretty sure it's six. Like you can't make more than six payments, you know, within a billing cycle, which no problem. Like I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. That would be a little too much attention to detail.
Yes, exactly. And because truly it doesn't really matter. Like if you want to be able to keep up with those purchases, you know, like every week or so, I think that's totally fine. I kind of keep up with our expenses like three times a month, like at the beginning, a third of the way through, another third of the way through, and then kind of like at the end, which I guess
is also the beginning.
Yeah. I guess it's just kind of like four. But more than that, it's kind of a waste of time, and it's not something that I want to preoccupy my mind with.
Totally. So, Bedelia, you're doing a great job. Don't worry too much. I think it's okay to worry less than you're worrying now about how you're paying off your credit card bills and maybe doing it less frequently so that it doesn't, you know, dominate your thoughts. But best of luck to you. All right, Matt, let's get to our final question of this episode. This one is about what do you do when you're kind of hitting the income limits of being able to contribute to a Roth IRA?
Hi, Matt and Joel. This is Tom calling in from Orlando. I have a question about maximum contributions to an IRA. As you know, the limit for a married couple filing jointly in 2021 is $6,000, as long as your combined modified adjusted gross income is under $198,000. I feel blessed that my wife and I are approaching that combined modified AGI number, but the issue is that I typically like to max out both of our IRA accounts in January so that I can take advantage of more time in the market, and I'm uncertain if I will be over that threshold by the end of the year. Both of us are expecting merit increases this year for our upcoming annual reviews, and I've already put $1,000 into each account. I'm not sure if I should wait until the end of the year when I definitively know our combined modified AGI before I put the remainder in. To make things more complicated, it seems that if your modified AGI is between $198,000 and $208,000, you can contribute a quote-unquote reduced amount, but I couldn't find any details on how to calculate that. I'm guessing it's maybe a linear scale, but I'm not really sure. My last question is, what happens if I find out that I did go over the contribution limit during the next tax filing? Will TurboTax or H&R Block guide me through how to resolve that, or am I on my own to monitor it and make any corrections? As you can see, I'm a bit lost here, so I'd appreciate any guidance you guys can give. Thanks for keeping me on track, and keep doing what you're doing. Cheers.
All right, Tom, this is a great question, and actually this is something that we've never really covered before, so I'm excited to kind of dive into it. But first of all,
love the nerdy details.
Yeah, dude, I'm all about the nerdy details. I love it. But two, I wanted to say congrats to you and your wife for approaching that income threshold, even though it might keep you from being able to fully participate in some retirement accounts. That is a good problem to have. And actually, you know, that's a great place to start, your income. And so like you mentioned, in order to fully contribute to a Roth IRA, you and your wife's modified adjusted gross income, or your, I guess, do you say MAGI or
Maggie?
MAGI. It needs to be $198,000 or less. But since we're such big fans of the Roth, man, if I were in your shoes, I would still move forward and fully fund both of your Roths now, since you already have that account, you know, up and running, and to take advantage of as much growth this year as possible. Just like you mentioned, I'm a huge fan of kind of doing that lump sum investing at the beginning of the year. But then, if you get to the end of the year and your MAGI
Maggie
is over the limit, at that point, what you can do is recharacterize from a Roth to a traditional IRA. I wouldn't wait until the end of the year to contribute to your Roth IRA at all.
Yeah, Matt, let's talk about recharacterization for a second.
A fancy term.
Yeah, it is. And basically that allows you to change an IRA contribution from one type to another. The change is going to be recorded as if the contribution were originally made to the second IRA. So in your case, the traditional IRA. And the tax benefit that you would receive from that second IRA is a tax benefit that you're left with. So for example, if you pay taxes now on any money that you contribute to a Roth, but then were to recharacterize it to a traditional IRA later on, you would still be able to get that tax break on those contributions.
That's right. And let's talk about timing a little bit here too, because typically you would have until your tax filing deadline to make that recharacterization. And so for most folks, that's April 15th. But if someone else is listening and you know they've already filed their tax return or filed for an extension, what's really cool is that the IRS will grant you an automatic 6-month extension from the standard April 15th tax deadline to October 15th. That's pretty cool. However, it's worth pointing out, though, that you may need to file an amended tax return.
Yeah, for Tom, this would be April 2022 in all likelihood that he would be facing these issues.
Exactly.
But then also, too, some of the tax benefit that you would receive from that traditional IRA is dependent on whether or not you and your spouse have workplace-sponsored retirement accounts. Because if that's the case, there are additional limitations on the amount of the tax deduction that you'd be able to take advantage of, too. We're not going to dive into that in detail because you didn't give any more details on that, but be sure to keep that in mind, too. That could have a significant effect on your ability to have any sort of tax advantage, even in a traditional IRA. So make sure to keep that in mind as well.
That's right. And so basically on to Tom's second question. He had a lot of questions.
But Tom, it could be complex stuff. I understand.
Yeah. You basically were asking about the phase out between, you know, if you earned between $198,000 and $208,000 for IRAs. And yes, it is linear and it's evenly distributed. And so, for example, if you made, say, $198,500, then you're going to be limited to contribute not $6,000, but $5,700. And so then if you made, say, $198,900, you're going to be limited to $5,460. You're getting closer to that next cutoff amount. And so Fidelity actually has a calculator that we can link to in our show notes where you can enter in your exact adjusted gross income.
Your Maggie.
Your Maggie at the end of the year. That way you'll know exactly how much you can contribute to your IRA.
Gotta love the internet, Matt. Full of fancy, helpful calculators.
I will say it was difficult. Like, I think they were the only ones who had a calculator like that. You know, there's other calculators out there, compounding interest calculators and all that kind of stuff. Yep. But not a lot of folks are asking for your modified adjusted gross income.
And, for the Roth phase out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's kind of a specific one. So yeah, we'll definitely make sure to link to that in the show notes.
Totally. And as to whether or not, too, Tom, on your last question, your tax prep software will flag this, depends on the specific software you're using. But we kind of doubt it. Even if they send a notification, you'll likely have to manually log in to wherever you have your Roth IRA and initiate the recharacterization of that IRA yourself, if that's something you wanted to do. I know that Vanguard has an online form and process that's pretty easy to do. Most custodians will automatically calculate any earnings and losses for you as well. So it's not as painful of a process as it might appear. You should be able to do it yourself without too much difficulty.
Yeah, that's right. So, Tom, again, congrats on becoming a higher wage earner, you know, like where you're kind of getting phased out of being able to take advantage of some of these tax advantaged accounts, some of these benefits, some of these deductions. But again, that is a good problem to have. And hopefully we've kind of got you thinking in the right direction on you know, how it is that you should be investing these additional dollars as you continue to earn more money. And Joel, let's go ahead and shift gears. Let's take it back to the beer that you and I enjoyed on this episode. This one is called The Dark Side of the Strawberry Moon. This one is by Cherry Street Brewing, who I am pretty sure we've had beers on by them on the show before. But we have never had this one before. What were your thoughts?
I do love a good Cherry Street beer. They make great stuff. And man, I love a strawberry sour beer. So yeah, this one had like a little Pink Floyd reference in the name and on the graphics.
Did you ever go through a Pink Floyd phase?
Never did.
You never kind of went through that classic rock?
I never watched The Wizard of Oz while listening to Pink Floyd backwards. Wasn't that a thing?
Yeah, it was totally a thing. Back in the day, so at UGA, the Georgia Theater used to actually play The Wizard of Oz where it was synced up to The Dark Side of the Moon.
Was it backwards or no? I don't remember.
I don't think it was backwards, but you definitely had to start the album like at a certain point in the movie.
Gotcha.
For it to all line up, basically.
And was it cool?
I never did it.
So. Okay, all right.
I just have heard the stories.
Well, I'm not a Pink Floyd guy, and maybe it's just because I haven't really given them a shot. Maybe I should. But the beer was good.
Yeah.
And it was tart. It was fruity. A little bit of strawberry sweetness going on at the same time. It felt like a perfect spring beer. And since spring is all the way out now,
spring's
here,
man. Spring has sprung.
Yeah, it's nice to have a delicious strawberry beer to celebrate. So really, really enjoyed this one.
Yeah, it had nice berry notes going on. And I'll point out, there's a difference between a beer with strawberry in it versus a beer with strawberry jam. We've had several beers, interestingly enough, that incorporate strawberry jam. And it has a very different flavor because I don't know what it is about strawberry jam, but it like, I don't know if it's the fermentation or just the way that jam makers process strawberries, but it has a very unique flavor. This one's a little cleaner drinking. It doesn't kind of have that funk going on, but it was still very, very berry, very enjoyable. And with it being a wheat beer, you know, it definitely kind of had that weedy, chewy finish that oftentimes reminds me of Captain Crunch.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to get away from that, but yeah, really enjoy this one. Glad that you and I got to enjoy this one today on this beautiful spring day, dude.
Me too, man. I really dug this beer, and I dug this episode at the same time. But that's going to close it out for this episode. We really appreciate you listening, and if you want to check out the show notes, some of the links that we mentioned during this episode, just go to our website, howtomoney.com. You'll find all of them there. I think we had a lot of links, a fair amount of links in this one.
Yeah, and if you've listened to the show and you've found it enjoyable, if you found it helpful, resourceful, we would love for you to leave us a solid review over at Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you listen to your podcast. It helps us to get the word out. It helps others to discover the show and to get them kind of on the right path to doing smart things with their money. So thanks in advance for that. Joel, that's going to be it for this episode, buddy. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.